Good morning. Good morning. It's good to be here this morning. It's good to have this opportunity to worship God with each of you. It's a blessing to be able to gather around the table as we just did and partake of the bread and the cup and remember the sacrifice that our King made for us. We're grateful for our visitors who've come to be here with us this morning. We're grateful for that encouragement and the opportunity that we all have to worship God together. If you would please turn to Matthew chapter 12. Matthew chapter 12, this is going to be our main text for the morning, though we will go and look at several Old Testament passages that that are referenced and alluded to in this passage. But Matthew chapter 12, the first eight verses, let's read those right now. Matthew chapter 12, beginning in verse 1. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples became hungry and began to pick the heads of grain and eat. But when the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, "Look, your disciples do what is not lawful to do on a Sabbath." But he said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he became hungry, he and his companions, how he entered the house of God, and they ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those with him, but for the priests alone? Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple break the Sabbath and are innocent? But I say to you that something greater than the temple is here. But if you had known what this means, 'I desire compassion and not a sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the innocent. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." So in this account, the setup is that Jesus and his disciples, they're walking along, they're passing some fields of grain, and his disciples, they pluck heads, some of the heads off of the stalks of the grain, they rub them between their hands, and they eat it. And this might seem like an odd thing to us to do. I don't think we normally do this kind of thing today in our culture. But this would have been something that was common at this time in Israel. In fact, it's something that's even mentioned in the law. So I'll read very quickly Deuteronomy 23. You can turn there if you'd like, but I'm just going to read very quickly verse 25. Deuteronomy 23 and verse 25. "When you enter your neighbor's standing grain, then you may pluck the heads with your hand, but you shall not wield a sickle in your neighbor's standing grain." So it's even something that's called out in the law as something that is allowed for the Israelites to do. But the question at hand, the issue at hand in Matthew 12 is not whether doing this just in general is okay. The question is, can you do this on the Sabbath? That's the question. That is what the Pharisees have an issue with, is, hey, your disciples did this on the Sabbath. And the idea, my understanding of the idea is that the Pharisees, they would have considered this as reaping. Now, was reaping something that would have been not allowed on the Sabbath? Yes. I want us to actually look at a few rules about the Sabbath here in just a moment. But that's the idea, that the Pharisees would have been accusing the disciples of reaping on the Sabbath. And so that's the question at hand. I just want to establish right off the bat that I don't believe that the disciples are violating the Sabbath here. I don't believe that what they're doing is a violation of any Sabbath law that we see in the Old Testament that we'll look at here in just a moment. But whether or not what they're doing is an actual violation of the Sabbath, at the end of the day, I don't think that's going to matter when we see the point that Jesus is going to make throughout the rest of this account. But I will say, just from looking at Scripture, I don't believe that what the disciples are doing here is violating the Sabbath. And I say that really for two reasons. One is right here in Matthew 12. So Matthew 12, verse 7, Jesus says, "But if you had known what this means, 'I desire compassion and not a sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the innocent." So here Jesus calls his disciples innocent. And so from that, I take it that they have not violated the Sabbath here. That Jesus is calling them innocent. Now, perhaps they're innocent for another reason that we'll speak about later, but I think what he's saying here is they're innocent. They haven't violated any Sabbath law. The other reason that I would suggest to you that the disciples are not breaking the Sabbath stems from various laws that we see in the Old Testament. So if you will, turn back to Exodus with me, please. Exodus chapter 20. We're going to look at just a few passages here in Exodus and then one in Deuteronomy. Exodus chapter 20, as you're turning there, this is the This is when Moses receives the Ten Commandments from the law, as God is beginning to give the law to Israel here at Mount Sinai after they've come out of Egypt. And so in Exodus 20 and verse 8, one of the Ten Commandments has to do with the Sabbath, and this is the first time that we see the Sabbath being discussed, at least under the name of the Sabbath. So Exodus 20 and verse 8, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male or your female servant or your cattle or your sojourner who stays with you. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy." Turn over a few chapters, please, to Exodus 23. Exodus 23 and verse 12. Exodus chapter 23, verse 12. 6 days you are to do your work, but on the seventh day you shall cease from labor, so that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the son of your female servant as well as your stranger may refresh themselves. A few more chapters now to Exodus 31. Exodus 31, also verse 12. Exodus 31, verse 12. "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, But as for you, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, You shall surely observe my Sabbaths, for this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you." And then he goes on to list very similar things from Exodus chapter 20. He calls them in verse 16, he talks about how they will celebrate the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant, and how it's a sign between God and the children of Israel. In Exodus 35, verse 2, Exodus chapter 35, verse 2 says, "For 6 days work may be done, but on the seventh day you shall have a holy day, a Sabbath of complete rest to the Lord. Whoever does any work on it shall be put to death. You shall not kindle a fire in any of your dwellings on the Sabbath day." So here we see what the punishment is for violating the Sabbath, and also a little bit more of a specific law given about not even kindling a fire on the Sabbath day. Finally, let's look at Deuteronomy chapter 5, please. Deuteronomy chapter 5. So Deuteronomy, if we remember from when we studied this earlier this year, Deuteronomy is the death address of Moses. Moses is speaking to the new generation of Israelites right as Joshua is about to lead them into the Promised Land. And he's reminding them of the covenant that their fathers entered into at Sinai, the covenant that their fathers broke, but that they are now renewing as they're entering into the Promised Land. And so in Deuteronomy 5, we have a recounting of the Ten Commandments. But I want us to look specifically at verses 15 through 17, where we get just a little bit more information about this instruction for the Sabbath that wasn't there in Exodus 20. So Deuteronomy 5, verse 15, "You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out of there by a mighty hand and by an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to observe the Sabbath day." So what do we see in all of these Old Testament passages about the Sabbath? I think we see that the emphasis was on the children of Israel being able to rest from their labors. This is God blessing the Israelites with a day of rest from their labors. And think about it from the context of the ancient Near East. They didn't have a five-day work week, right, where you get Saturday, Sunday off. That wouldn't have been the case back then. You work 7 days a week because you got to work the fields. You have to work 7 days a week. And so what God is doing as he's setting his people apart at Sinai, he says, you're going to take one of those days and you're going to rest from those labors. You're going to rest from those labors. You're going to trust that I'm going to provide for you, so you don't have to keep working day in and day out. You're going to trust that I'm going to provide for you, but you're going to rest from those labors. You're going to enjoy rest. But it wasn't just enjoying rest and the idea that they could, come in from the fields and kick back in their ancient recliner and sleep all day. The idea is that you're going to enjoy this rest that I first enjoyed when I created this world. I created this world in 6 days and then I rested on the seventh. And so now you get to enjoy that rest with me. You get to spend time not thinking about plowing the fields or anything like that. You get to spend, you have rest from that so that you can spend time focusing on me, on what I have done in creating this world, as we saw there in Deuteronomy 5, and what I have done for you in bringing you out of Egypt, in bringing you out and giving you salvation. That's what the Sabbath was about. That's what the Sabbath was for. And Mark's account of the same thing we read in Matthew 12, we can read about it in Mark chapter 2. In Mark chapter 2, we have the comment from Jesus that the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. That the Sabbath was a blessing for man, not something that was constrictive. But the Pharisees have turned it into something constrictive. But what we see here in these Old Testament passages, again, I believe is there's emphasis on rest from labor so that focus can be put on God and what he has done for Israel. And so as we consider that initial question of, are the disciples doing something wrong here? Are they violating the Sabbath? I don't see anything in these Old Testament laws that indicate that plucking a head of grain and rubbing it between your hands and eating what's in your hand is violating the Sabbath. I don't think that that the old law considered that reaping. Honestly, I think you could argue from what we read in Deuteronomy 23 that there's a clear distinction between plucking the heads of grain and going out there with a sickle and reaping what's there in the fields. So from the beginning, I don't believe that what we're seeing here is the disciples actually violating the Sabbath. But if that's the case, if they are not violating the Sabbath, which I don't think that they are, why doesn't Jesus just lead with that in his response? When Jesus responds to what the Pharisees to the statement that the Pharisees make here, why doesn't he lead with oh, well, no, you see, Pharisees, you're actually wrong in your understanding of the Sabbath and of what reaping is. And here, let's go back to these Old Testament, you know, for it was written, let's go back to these Old Testament passages and see why you really don't have a correct understanding of what reaping is. Why didn't he essentially do what we just did here? I think the reason that he doesn't do this and that he goes to some other Old Testament examples is because there's a greater issue at hand than simply defending the actions of his disciples. There's something deeper, there's something more troubling, more foundational going on here in the statement that the Pharisees make than simply an accusation against his disciples that Jesus then needs to defend his disciples from. I believe that's because the statement that the Pharisees make in verse 2 is not an honest statement. They say, look, your disciples do what is not lawful to do on a Sabbath. And so the focus, one could argue from the statement, is on the disciples, right? They're not saying anything about Jesus. They're saying, oh, your disciples aren't doing this. But in saying that, you know, look at how they phrase it. They said, look, your disciples do what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath. Your disciples do this. And so in stating it like this, really, they're not accusing Jesus' disciples. They're accusing Jesus himself. They're accusing Jesus as the teacher, as the rabbi, as teaching something that's not lawful, as condoning something that's not lawful. And so ultimately what we see here, what we see in the statement from the Pharisees, is an attack on Jesus' legitimacy, and it's an attack on Jesus's authority. And I believe that is why Jesus doesn't just launch right into an explanation, into the nuances of what reaping was and what it wasn't. Jesus understands there's a deeper problem here. There's a deeper accusation here than simply violation of the Sabbath. They don't recognize who Jesus is. They don't recognize his authority. And so Jesus is going to take this as an opportunity to point that out and to point out who he is. So as we read what Jesus has to say, the backdrop for his response is this refusal from the Pharisees to recognize his authority as king. So as we look at his response, the first part of his response references an account that we read in 1 Samuel 21 and 22. So if you will, please go ahead and turn back there with me. 1 Samuel chapter 21. 1 Samuel 21, so this is back in the time of the United Kingdom under King Saul. But David has been anointed as king, but he and Saul are, Saul is trying to kill him. Saul is trying to kill David here in 1 Samuel 21. That's the context of this chapter. So David is running from Saul. In 1 Samuel chapter 21, verse 1, I want us to read a few verses here to make sure we understand this account. Then David came to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest, and Ahimelech came trembling to meet David and said to him, why are you alone and no one with you? David said to Ahimelech the priest, the king has commissioned me with the matter and has said to me, let no one know anything about the matter on which I'm sending you and with which I've commissioned you. And I've directed the young men to a certain place. Now, therefore, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever can be found. The priest answered David and said, there is no ordinary bread on hand, but there is consecrated bread, if only the young men have kept themselves from women. David answered the priest and said to him, surely women have been kept from us as previously when I set out, and the vessels of the young men were holy, though it was an ordinary journey. How much more than today will their vessels be holy? So the priest gave him consecrated bread, for there was no bread there but the bread of the presence, which was removed from before the Lord, in order to put hot bread in its place when it was taken away. Now one of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's shepherds. So David comes to the priest here at Nob, and he asks him for food. He says, listen, I'm on a mission. He's lying to him about that, but he tells the priest, I need food. What food do you have? Please give it to me. And the priest says, listen, we don't have any food here. All we have is the bread of the presence. And when we think about the bread of the presence, we read about that back in Leviticus 24. Back in Leviticus 24, starting in verse 5, if you want to turn there, Leviticus chapter 24 and verse 5, we read of this bread of the presence. Leviticus 24 and verse 5. God says, then you shall take fine flour and bake 12 cakes with it. 2 tenths of an ephah shall be in each cake. You shall set them in 2 rows, 6 to a row, on the pure gold table before the Lord. You shall put pure frankincense on each row, that it may be a memorial portion for the bread, even an offering by fire to the Lord. Every Sabbath day he shall set it in order before the Lord continually. It is an everlasting covenant for the sons of Israel. It shall be for Aaron and his sons, and they shall eat it in a holy place, for it is most holy to him from the Lord's offerings by fire, his portion forever. So that's the bread of the presence that we're talking about here in 1 Samuel 21. This is something that is specifically given to Aaron and his sons, so to the priest, right? Not to anybody who comes through, but to the priest specifically. And so that's all that's there when David shows up to the tabernacle. And so Ahimelech, he tells him, listen, this is all I have, but if y'all have kept yourselves from women, then here, I can give you this bread. And so we have to ask ourselves the question, why does Ahimelech do this? Why does Ahimelech give this qualification that you can have the bread that's only for the priest if you've kept yourselves from women? Why does he say that? You know, and there could be several answers to that question. One answer could be that he just simply went rogue and added something to the law. That could be what's going on here. It could be that Ahimelech, he sees a need, and he decides that addressing that need is the greater good that can be done, is the greater service that could be done than simply keeping the letter of the law. And perhaps one would say that Ahimelech was keeping the spirit of the law instead of keeping the letter of the law. Perhaps, though, there's another and a more proper explanation that's right here in the text in 1 Samuel. Because remember, that bread of the presence, that was God's bread, right? It was mentioned several times there in Leviticus 24 that this bread is put before the Lord. It's put before the Lord. And that what Aaron and his sons eat is from the Lord's offerings by fire. So this is God's bread that he has given to the priest. So in 1 Samuel 21, verse 7, we read that one of Saul's servants was there, this Doeg the Edomite, who is the chief of Saul's shepherds. As we look in the next chapter, in 1 Samuel 22, in verse 8, Saul is questioning why he thinks that his officials and his commanders are helping David, and he's just kind of railing against them about this and asking why aren't y'all helping? Why are y'all keeping all these things from me? And then in verse 9, then Doeg the Edomite, who is standing by the servants of Saul, said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob to Ahimelech the son of Ahitub. He inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Ahimelech didn't go rogue. Ahimelech didn't decide on his own that, oh, there's a greater need here, and so I'm going to set aside this law from God, and I'm going to deal with this need. Ahimelech went to God. Ahimelech inquired of the Lord when David came to him. So the obvious implication there is that God told Ahimelech, you can give this to David. You can give this bread to David. Now, did God have the authority to do that? Yes, God had the authority to do that. It was his bread, right? That's what we read back in Leviticus 24. It was God's bread in the first place. And so because it was God's bread, because God is the one who gave the law, he has the right, he has the authority to instruct Ahimelech to give that bread to David in this circumstance. Ahimelech, he goes to God and he receives this explicit instruction from God to do this thing. And so when David eats of this bread, David's not breaking the law. This isn't a situation where David broke the law, but then God was merciful to him. David's not breaking the law here because God said it was okay. Because God specifically said that it was okay. And again, God has the right to do this. He's not bound by his law. He is the giver of the law. He is the giver of the law. He is, you might say, the Lord of the law. And as Lord of the law, he gets to decide how it's applied. Now, Ahimelech could not have done this on his own. Ahimelech could not have taken God's law and said, you know what, I think in this situation, this needs to be done instead. David could not have just waltzed in there and grabbed the bread of the presence and gone and eaten it. But God, as the Lord of the law, has the authority to instruct Ahimelech in this matter. And I believe that this is why Jesus brings this account up back in Matthew chapter 12. He's showing that God, as the Lord of the law, has the insight into the law and has the authority over the law to determine what his servants can and cannot do. And he illustrates that with this passage from 1 Samuel 21, where God allows his servants to do something that otherwise would not have been allowed to do. The second example that Jesus gives there in Matthew 12 has to do with the priests and how they are, and the Levites, and how they are ministering in the tabernacle or in the temple, even on the Sabbath day. So turn with me, please, to Numbers 28. Numbers 28. This verse has to do with some of the offerings that are made in the tabernacle and later in the temple. Numbers 28, beginning in verse 9. So then on the Sabbath day, two male lambs, 1 year old without defect, and 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil as a grain offering and its drink offering. This is the burnt offering of every Sabbath in addition to the continual burnt offering and its drink offering. So we have, there were burnt offerings that were offered every day, morning and evening, right? But here God instructs that on the Sabbath day, you still have your morning and evening offerings, but there's an additional Sabbath offering that is to be made. So the priests are out there cutting up animals, moving the pieces of the animals around, doing all of this labor, all of this work on the Sabbath day. If you turn back to Leviticus 6, Leviticus chapter 6, we'll look in verse 12. Leviticus chapter 6 and verse 12, here are some specific instructions for the priest and their parts in the offering. So Leviticus 6 and verse 12, the fire on the altar shall be kept burning on it. It shall not go out, but the priest shall burn wood on it every morning. And he shall lay out the burnt offering on it and offer up in smoke the fat portions of the peace offerings on it. Fire shall be kept burning continually on the altar. It is not to go out. What was one of the actually specific commands that we read in Numbers, or in Exodus, sorry, about what is not to be done on the Sabbath? It was kindling a fire, right? But here, in Leviticus 6, that's part of the daily things that the priests are to do. Daily, this fire is to be kept burning continually. Not let it burn for 6 days, and then let it go out on Saturday, and then rekindle it on Sunday. It's continually there to be keeping this fire going. And so I believe these are the kinds of things that Jesus is referencing in Matthew 12 when he says, you know, don't you know that on the Sabbath day the priests serving in the temple profane the Sabbath yet are innocent? The priests are doing these things that otherwise would have been a capital offense, but they're doing these things because God told them to. And no one would have looked at the priest there in the tabernacle and thought, oh, look at those Sabbath violators. No, they're doing what God, the Lord of the law, the Lord of the Sabbath, what he has instructed them to do. And so it's a very similar point, I believe, to what we saw from 1 Samuel 21 and 22, that when God specifies something, it's allowed. Full stop. Like no questions about that. When God specifies something, that is the law, that is the rule, and it is allowed, even if it's something that otherwise there would have been problems with it, right? If there's a priest who's not serving at the time, but he's just back at his home in whatever priestly Levitical city he lives in, and he goes out and he starts butchering an animal to eat it, and he starts, you know, going and getting some firewood and kindling a fire, well, no, that would be wrong, because God said that. But if he's doing it in the temple because he's serving in the temple, well, God expressly commanded that. he commanded his servants, the priests, to do this. So I think the point that we need to see here, the point that Jesus is trying to make, is that something cannot break the law if the Lord of the law allows it. Something cannot break the law if the Lord of the law allows it. This is what he's trying to get the Pharisees to understand here. And he tells them then in verse 6, he says, "But I say to you that something greater than the temple is here." Like, we've been talking about David. We've been talking about the temple and the temple worship. Something greater than that is going on right in front of y'all, and you're missing it. You're missing it. And so we then see verses 7 and 8, which I believe are really the climax of this point Jesus is making. He says, "But if you had known what this means, I desire compassion and not a sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. So there in verse 7, that we have this sentence, "I desire compassion and not a sacrifice." Some of your versions might read, "I desire mercy and not sacrifice." This is a quotation. This is a quotation from Hosea 6. So please turn there with me. Hosea 6, the first of the minor prophets. So we go, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea. Hosea after Daniel, before Joel. Hosea chapter 6. And if you've studied the prophet Hosea, you might remember that he is the prophet whom God told to go and marry a prostitute. God tells Hosea at the beginning of the book, "Go take for yourself a prostitute as a wife." And believe it or not, the prostitute cheats on him. And then God tells Hosea, "Go take her back, bring her back, buy her back, and take her again as your wife." And this is an object lesson for those around to understand what God's relationship with Israel has been like. How Israel has constantly forsaken their covenant with him, cheated on him with other gods, other nations. Yet God keeps being merciful. He keeps coming back to them and taking them back. And so that's the overall context of Hosea, that Israel and Judah have been unfaithful to their covenant with God. And we see beginning in Hosea chapter 6 and verse 4, "What shall I do with you, O Ephraim? What shall I do with you, O Judah? For your loyalty is like a morning cloud and like the dew which goes away early. Therefore I have hewn them in pieces by the prophets. I have slain them by the words of my mouth, and the judgments on you are like the light that goes forth. For I delight in loyalty rather than sacrifice, and in the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. But like Adam they have transgressed the covenant. There they have dealt treacherously against me. Gilead is a city of wrongdoers, tracked with bloody footprints. And as raiders wait for a man, so a band of priests murder on the way to Shechem. Surely they have committed crime." So it's Hosea chapter 6 and verse 6 specifically, or the first part of Hosea 6 and verse 6 that Jesus quotes there in Matthew 12. And so, as you read it in Matthew 12, I'm reading from the New American Standard, and it says, "I desire compassion." Some of your translations might say, "I desire mercy." Back in Hosea 6, the New American reads it, "For I delight in loyalty rather than sacrifice." Why are there all these different words here? Why do all of our different translations have all these different words used here in this verse? It's because the word that they're translating there is a word that really doesn't have a good one-for-one translation into English. It's a word that we're familiar with. It's a word that a good number of us who were here a couple of Wednesday nights ago, we all repeated this word together over and over and over again. In Psalm 136, that psalm we talked about as a call and response psalm, each verse of that psalm ends with the phrase, "For his loving kindness endures forever," or "For his steadfast love endures forever." And it's that word that we translate as steadfast love or loving kindness. We also translate it as mercy, as compassion, as loyalty. The word is hesed, H-E-S-E-D, hesed. And so here in Hosea 6:6, it's "For I delight in hesed rather than sacrifice." In Psalm 136, it's "For his hesed endures forever." And this is a word that more often than not is used to refer to the covenant faithfulness that God has to his people, the covenant loyalty that God has to his people. That's what hesed means. And so here in Hosea 6, verse 6, he's calling on his people to demonstrate that same level of loyalty and commitment to him that he has demonstrated to them. He says, listen, I don't want your sacrifices. Yes, on some level, the law required sacrifices. But the whole point of God, you know, coming to Israel in the first place and initiating that covenant at Sinai, the whole point of that was not so that he could get a bunch of sacrifices offered to him. The whole point of that was so that he could have a relationship with his people. That's what he wanted. He wanted that relationship with them. And he's begging them here in Hosea 6, verse 6, to want that relationship with him. He says, listen, I don't want you to bring your sacrifices. I want you to bring yourselves. I want you to bring your loyalty. I want you to bring your allegiance. I want you to bring your faithfulness to me. You know, I don't want your burnt offerings, he says there at the end of verse 6. He says, I want you to know me. I want you to have knowledge of me. That's what I want. And this idea of knowledge in Scripture, it's often not just the idea of like an academic knowledge of like, oh, I know some facts about God. The idea of knowledge in Scripture often has the idea of an experiential knowledge. You know, at the beginning of Genesis 4, it says that Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore to him Cain. That word there, knew, it's obviously, it's a euphemism for the sexual relationship that Adam had with his wife Eve. But it's that idea of this experiential knowledge, this intimate relationship that one can have with another. And so that's what God is asking his people, is begging his people for here in Hosea 6 and verse 6. Listen, I want you to know me. I want you to experience the blessings of relationship with me. I want you to be loyal to me as I have been loyal to you. So this is what Jesus quotes here as the Pharisees challenge his authority. He quotes this passage from Hosea where God is begging his people to recognize him and to desire the relationship with him. And if the Pharisees in Matthew 12 had understood that lesson from Hosea, then they would not have condemned Jesus' disciples. If they were truly faithful to the covenant, if they had a true knowledge of God, they would have recognized that God's standing right there in front of them. They would have recognized God is right there in front of them. They would have recognized him as Lord of the Sabbath, and they would have understood that his disciples would not have been violating the Sabbath day. I want us to think through this for a moment. Think through this, this hypothetical, if the Pharisees had recognized Jesus' authority, if they recognized him as the Son of God on earth. So if that were the case, if they recognized his authority, then they might not have even seen this as a violation of the Sabbath in the first place. But even if they still had that mindset, they're like, and they see his disciples, and in their mind they're like, oh, well, isn't that violating the Sabbath? If the Pharisees thought that Jesus was the Son of God, was the Lord of the Sabbath, they would not have come to him dishonestly accusing him through his disciples. They would have come to him honestly, recognizing his authority, recognize his wisdom, and they would have asked him, like, hey, what's going on here? What are we missing? Not, hey, you're doing something wrong. Your disciples are doing something wrong. But, hey, listen, we recognize that you're the Lord of the Sabbath. We see some of your disciples doing this thing that we thought was wrong. So obviously that means there's something wrong with our thinking. So will you please explain to us what's wrong with our thinking and why this is an okay thing to do? I think that's what would have happened if they had recognized his authority, but that's not what happens. That's not what they do. They come to him rejecting who he is, rejecting his authority, and they accuse him through his disciples. And so I believe that it's this rejection of his authority. I believe that's the reason that Jesus doesn't simply explain why they're wrong. I think this is why Jesus goes back to 1 Samuel 21. It's why he goes back to the priest serving in the temple to demonstrate that, listen, God has an authority that is even greater than the authority of the law, because God was the giver of the law. And God can allow his servants to do things if he so chooses. Now, again, I don't think that the disciples were doing anything wrong here in the first place, but even if they were, even if this was a violation of the Sabbath, obviously Jesus has condoned it, and he has the authority to do that as the Lord of the Sabbath. But the Pharisees reject that. They reject his authority, and so he uses these examples, these accounts, to drive home that point, to sidestep the superficial issue of can I rub some grain between my hands on the Sabbath. He sidesteps that to deal with the heart issue, the most foundational issue, which is a rejection of his authority, a rejection of his identity. And so as we read this passage, you know, it's easy for us to read it and you know, beat up on the Pharisees. Their hypocrisy, and how could they be so blind? And really, you can't pluck a head of grain on the Sabbath. You're calling that reaping, and that's all valid to some degree. But we can't get lost in that to the point where we miss the application for ourselves today. And so there are really two things that I just want us to consider as we begin to bring this lesson to a close. The first thing, I'm going to mention is dealing with a misuse of this passage. So we're going to deal with the misuse of the passage, and then we're going to get to what I think the correct use of the passage is. But it is not uncommon at all for someone to take Matthew 12 and really key in on verse 7, I desire compassion or mercy and not sacrifice. It is very common for someone to take this passage and from it draw the conclusion that it is okay for me to break one of God's laws in order to uphold what is, quote, a higher law. You know, it's okay for me to break a lesser law in order to keep a higher law. And they would call it verse 7, you know, it was more important to be compassionate, to be merciful, than to offer sacrifice. You might hear phrasing like, you know, I'm going to break the letter of the law so that I can keep the spirit of the law. Now, don't get me wrong. The spirit of the law is a thing. There's much more to God's laws than simply the words on the page, the surface-level instructions. And just to illustrate that point briefly, you think back in Leviticus, there was a law about, hey, you can't weave a garment together using two different kinds of cloths, two different kinds of material. There's nothing morally wrong with wearing 80% polyester, 20% cotton. It's probably the opposite. There's nothing wrong with wearing garments like that. So why did God give them that law? Well, it wasn't for the superficial reason that he didn't want them wearing blended clothing. It was for the point. It was for the spirit behind that law, which was that, listen, you're wholly set apart for me. You are not to be mixed with any of the nations. You are not to be mixed with any other desires, any other priorities besides being holy to me, as I am your holy God. That was the spirit of that law. So I say all that to say, the spirit of the law is very much a thing. But the spirit of the law will never be in conflict with the letter of the law. There will never be a time where I am required to break one of God's laws in order to keep the spirit of the law. If that were the case, this would be an imperfect law, and it's the perfect law of liberty. But that is a way that this passage can be used. And this argument that, you know, I'm going to set aside this law to keep this higher law, first, that just violates pretty much all of the Bible, that there are times when it's okay to break God's law. But another question that I would raise about that is, okay, so let's say that's the case. Let's say that maybe there are some occasions where I need to break one law in order to keep another law. Well, who's to say when I find myself in one of those situations? Who's to say when's the time that I can do that? Because I don't know of any guidance in scriptures that says, okay, this is when you keep this law, but break this law. I don't see that in scripture. And so if that's the case, if there's going to be a time where I may have to break a law in order to keep a law, I'm relying on my own wisdom, on my own insight, in order to determine when I'm in one of those situations. I'm relying on my own judgment, not God's judgment. And honestly, that's like the definition of sin. When you think of the garden, when Eve took of that fruit and she ate it, she was trusting in her own judgment. She saw that it was good. She saw for herself. She decided for herself it was good, and it was better to eat the fruit than keep the law that God had given. So like at the foundational level, doing that is violating God's law. But I think that this teaching comes from a misunderstanding of this word hesed. Maybe not even a misunderstanding, maybe not even a realization that it's there. Because I will say that in English, as I read, if I come to Matthew 12, verse 7, and it's my first time looking at it, and I don't know anything about Hesed. I don't know that, oh, there's this word. If I don't know anything about that, I read, I desire compassion and not a sacrifice. I desire mercy and not a sacrifice. I can understand how some people can start with that phrase and go off in the direction of, sometimes I got to break one law to keep another one. It doesn't mean it's right, but I understand how people can go down that thought process. However, when I as I'm reading Scripture and I'm coming to understand God's covenant faithfulness to His people, and I read the word compassion, but then I see it as mercy, then I turn and I look at it in Hosea and it's loyalty, and I'm realizing, okay, there's something going on. This isn't just simply, you know, generic mercy or generic compassion. This is talking about God's faithfulness. This is talking about faithfulness, loyalty, and that is what God is asking for. He's desiring loyalty, covenant faithfulness, and not a sacrifice. And so ultimately, He's calling me to be faithful to His laws. He's calling me to be faithful to His covenants, which is the opposite of what some might try to argue from this. And finally, this idea of, I got to break one law to keep another one, it just goes against the main point of this passage even specifically. Because the point of this passage, the point that Jesus is trying to get the Pharisees to understand, is that God is the authority, and that Jesus as God is the authority, and that we check our judgments at the door, and we submit to His judgments, to His laws, and gratefully do that. So I wanted to spend just a couple of minutes speaking about that misuse of this passage, because it is very prevalent, and it is very easy to fall into. But I hope that gives you some good things to consider in your own lives, and maybe if you're talking with someone who brings that up, maybe you have some things to discuss with them. The point of this passage is that we must recognize Jesus' authority as King in every regard. We must recognize Jesus' authority as King in every regard. That my life, my thoughts, my beliefs, my attitudes must be shaped by my faithfulness to Him, by my knowledge of Him. I have to recognize His authority and His wisdom, and then I have to change based on that. That's what the Pharisees were unwilling to recognize. They were unwilling to recognize that. They were unwilling to change. But I have to know Him. I have to be faithful to Him and all that He calls me to do and all that He calls me to not do. And oftentimes when we talk about the authority of Jesus as King and submitting to that, I think we often think about being too loose with His rules, too loose with His laws and commandments, and that's very much part of it. That I'm not recognizing His authority as King if I'm doing things He's told me to not do, right? If I'm being too loose with His laws and commands and examples and instructions. But what was the problem with the Pharisees here? Was the problem with the Pharisees that, you know, you have the Sabbath laws here, but they're like down here, not keeping the Sabbath law? That wasn't the problem with the Pharisees. The problem with the Pharisees was that the Sabbath law is right here, and they've gone up here. And they're adding these things to it, and they're holding these things and binding these things. That was the problem with the Pharisees, that they were not recognizing Jesus' authority. They were adding to Jesus' authority. They were saying, hey, your authority didn't go far enough, so we're going to go farther, and we're gonna use this as a stick to beat people with. They were holding people to a stricter law than what God, the Lord of the law, had given. And I think sometimes we can think that, you know, if we're trying to figure something out, you know, the safe option is the strictest option. But that's not the case. The safe option is the option that is in keeping with the teachings and the example of our King. That's what the safe option is. And I cannot swing to either side, being too loose or too strict with the laws, with the instructions and the examples that He has left for me. So as we close this morning, I ask you, are you living a life that is defined by Hesed? Are you living a life that is defined by complete and utter loyalty and faithfulness to the covenant that you have entered into with God? The covenant that you have entered into with your God, with your King, and the covenant that's only possible because your King died for you in the first place. Are you living a life that's defined by that faithfulness? Because that covenant relationship is only possible in the first place because of Him. And He is faithful to uphold His covenant. So are you? That's the question for us today. Are you faithful to uphold your covenant with your God? If you haven't been baptized, if you have not been baptized in the water, if you haven't died with Christ and risen up a new man with him, you haven't entered into that covenant in the first place, so you can't be faithful to it. And you're lost. So if that's your case, we beg you to come and to submit to his will, to submit to his authority this morning. If you have done that, but you're struggling with being faithful, you're struggling with submitting to the authority in every aspect of your life, then again, we would love to encourage you, we would love to help you submit to that as we're all trying to do. If there's anything like that that we can help you with this morning, please come forward and you let us know now as we stand and as we sing.